I found last week a very touching experience, and I thought we could begin just by checking in on anything you'd like to share about what happened for you when we were all here together last time. Martha?
So I'll be glad to begin. Even though I was raised in Protestant, I've always sort of had a something about the Sacred Heart has always sort of called me an image, and I never quite knew why. So when I saw this, I'll come and learn more about it. And I had been struggling with God as kind of the male part of God and the female part. How does that go together? Anyway, that was my background when I came last time. And somehow I was sitting here, and I can't even tell you at what point you were talking. And all of a sudden, I had this marvelous experience of suddenly everything kind of coming together, and this sense of just being held in the heart, you know, God's enormous heart of being held in it. And it was just absolutely wonderful. And I would ever expected to sit here in a lecture in the Perry Hall, you know, should be out, you know, in under a tree or having a praise for 6 weeks or something. Anyway, it was absolutely stunning. And the other thing that has stayed with me so much is that image of the cave. That has just come up over and over this week. So two absolutely life changing images, and thank you.
Thank you, Martha. And for those who don't know Martha, she's a priest in the Episcopal Church. And she's part of, you're part of Still Point.
Well, I'm retired, but I wouldn't.
Yeah. Other comments?
Jan? It was just like dropping down into that peaceful underneath the noise that used to go on. And the whole room seemed to do this. Conscious Evolution calls it the resonance circle. It was a morphic field. It felt like we all just dropped into that. Very sweet.
Good. And I also felt like I wasn't making anything happen, just felt like something was coming through for all of us. Other comments? Or even reactions you had during the week as you thought about some of the things we brought up?
It prompted me to go through all the old religious cards that I've had from my mother and my sister, collected and put away in a drawer, in a box. I went through everything I could find, and I collected as many as, I had more, but those would fit, and I put them together very lovingly in a little cellophane folder, and I got them over there on the table to display. But I had to do it. And I thought, well, I can read this pretty fast.
No.
It goes slowly.
Yeah, it's on the table and it's very lovely. Reminds us of our childhood.
Christiane? Nine luminaries of our time, three Christians, Muslims, three Hindu women. And the first one happened to be an Italian woman, Frances Cabrini, who devoted her whole life to the Christian cause, and who, despite a very frail health, accomplished an enormous amount of work on several continents, you know, numerous orphanage hospitals. And she just, all the strength came to her from meditating and loving the Holy Christ. She saw it at the heart of the work. Then when we were talking about the Pieta, the third woman in the book is a Russian Orthodox. And as she was holding her daughter dying, she thought, what am I going to do with all this pain? And the insight came to her that she was the mother of the world. Mm-hmm. And she became the mother to all Russian immigrants, and during World War II, every Jew in Paris came to her for help, and every person was a child in need. And she went all the way to the concentration camps, followed them, volunteered to the gas chamber because they were safe. And it goes on like that, the whole book. And it's very reminiscent of everything.
Thank you, Christina.
So I was reflecting on really what happened within me, or just observing what was going on. It did arise out of the whole conversation about the pietà and that woundedness. And I was thinking about, you know, Jesus and his appearance at, you know, after his resurrection appearances, you know, still had his wounds, and, you know, saying to Thomas, put your fingers in my wound. I think with when we enter that common woundedness, and maybe the woundedness is this longing for wholeness, and that's where we encounter, for me, God in universally. And I remember when we lost our home in the Painted Cave Fire, the enormous response from the entire community. It only happened in a certain segment of this town, but the entire community went to that wound. And I remember thinking at the time in the gospel where Jesus says, you know, don't look for, you know, the kingdom won't come. Signs don't say heaven. It's over there, or no, it's over there, or it's coming, it's there. It will arise up from within you. And I thought, this is exactly what happened. The kingdom was arising up from within the people in Santa Barbara, just rose up this compassion, rose up from within. So it's not happening outside. It rises up from within when everybody's focused on our common humanity. Something like that was all kind of coming back to me through the same type of thing that I felt sort of rising up here, a connectedness that was tangible that was happening. So it's very powerful. So thank you, because you allowed for that to, and thank you because you took the time and allowed for that to play out.
Mm-hmm.
That also
helped. Oh, yeah. Anybody else? Yes, Keith?
During the week, it came back to me several times what you said about symbols and how so many of those symbols that, you know, I learned through seminary and years ago, I've gotten so used to them, I just pass by. They don't say anything anymore. But they're there, but I wasn't. This really struck me. I've got to go back and take another look. What are the things like the Sacred Heart saying to me? It just kept coming back during the week, so that really, you really planted the seed. And I love that phrase. It's the symbol as the password.
Yes.
And when we forget the password, how much we miss. And stuff becomes too familiar, and it's old, and we pass it by. So going back for a second look, I guess, was my theme.
Good for you. Thank you, Keith. I always like your comments. Judy?
I had a continuation of last week while I was reading the book, and this quote by Juliana of Norwich, who had a vision, and the vision spoke to her, and it said, "Holy Church taught me that sinners are sometimes worthy of blame and wrath, but in my visions I could not see this in God. God is a goodness that cannot be wrathful." I just that really spoke to me. I saw no vengeance in God. Not for the short time, nor for the long time. God shows us no more blame than he does to the angels in heaven. Which is very comforting.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's a beautiful comment. Mary?
It was kind of a new consciousness for me, and yes, I was more aware of the connectedness of heart with people, but the main thing that touched me last week was the fact when you said that the ritual and the devotion is the heart. And I realized that in my own life that I don't intend to that. So I found that's really something that I need for that personal relationship, that devotion and that. I think I can have it on a, obviously, and it's just a different consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Good. Jean?
Because of personal choices and current circumstances, I find myself living mostly in my head. Mm-hmm. And when you said, if God had not wanted a personal relationship with us, he would have sent us a book. I psychology is a wonderful thing, but it just does not reach the gap.
No, it would never be enough.
Mm-hmm.
Good. Well, thank you all for the wonderful comments. And, I really felt the power of what happened. And I love the fact that it had a life of its own.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Within the group. That must be what they felt as the coming of the Spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And Jung had such an interesting comment, which I've always remembered, in his interpretation of the words of the Gospel, I will send you the Holy Spirit, he will teach you all things. That when the church makes dogmatic statements which are meant to last forever, it's contrary to that style that the Spirit wants to come through in new ways daily, and that it's a lack of trust in that Spirit teaching us. When you have to formulate it and say, well, this is what it is, and it stays like this forever, and you have to look at it just this way and use just these words, it doesn't show enough trust in that way the Spirit works. So hopefully we're going to do that within ourselves.
David, what's your experience? You were going to tell us your experience.
Mine was, again, the power of the Pietà, because of what I had said about my grandmother's comment, and I thought, you know, how it's touched me because, you know, it's like part of within my own family. And I could see how it all has just been there all these years and came out in a beautiful way here.
Dave?
Yeah.
Have you ever explored some of the other Michelangelo Pietas besides the one in? Because there's some really moving ones.
I saw the other ones in Florence. There's the one with Joseph of Arimathea holding Christ.
That's a really, I mean, that's
very powerful.
Something to men, too.
Mm-hmm.
You could be there. Yeah.
Yes. He has one where Joseph is holding Christ. He was very fascinated with that subject. So he kept coming back to it. I want to say one more thing before we go on to our subject today, which is the accessibility of mysticism for all of us. We shouldn't think of it as only for great saints. So we're going to talk about mysticism, but I hope I made it clear that the word sacred in Sacred Heart was used originally to make sure that people saw the heart of Christ as an object of adoration, and that sacred, in the way they're using it, the way they used it originally, had to do with honoring all the organs of Christ's body as suffused with divinity, And now we have a new way of using this word. And it means something has touched us at a very deep level. A very soulful connection has been made. And so Sacred Heart now has a different flavor from the original. The original was to make sure you got the point that you were supposed to adore. Now it's there's a new point being made, which is that this is something within yourself and within the universe and within Christ, and it's all one. It's sacred because this is the part of you that partakes of the divine. So it's a very important distinction. And as I said last time, since the heart is inside the body at all times, the fact that it's shown on the outside is a way of saying the interior life of God has now become accessible to us. That is why the heart's on the outside. That the deepest inner life of God is totally here for us. Not distant and far away, as might be thought of when you look at it from the perspective of adoration. Everybody fall?
Mm-hmm.
Good.
You also have something in the book about why it's on the left side.
Oh, yes. No, I just said that in a comical way. On the left side, you know, people who have a leftist political view seem to have more heart. So let's just take a look at the word mystical. This is a Greek word. M-Y-S-T-E-S. Is our way of putting it. Refers to an initiate, a person who is being initiated into secret and very precious and deep religious experience. And the ancient Greeks had a number of important sacraments, is what we would call them, which included pilgrimages to the actual places where certain divine events occurred. The greatest of all the mysteries was the mystery of Eleusis, E-L-E-U-S-I-S. This is a little town where the great goddess Demeter went to mourn the loss of her child, Persephone. And so it's the pietà without the presence of the body. She sat there by a well and cried because her daughter had been kidnapped by the god of the underworld. And so each year they made a pilgrimage from Athens to Eleusis. It's 16 miles walking, wearing white robes after purification rites. And they went through the experience of joining her in her grief. And then the high point of the ceremony was the holding aloft of an ear of wheat to show that she had come back to life. So it was a mystery of death and resurrection. And all the great philosophers and Marcus Aurelius and so forth that attended this, and
and the people who went through it were called misdeeds or initiates. So the first thing about mysticism within the word is that it's something that's special to you, but at the same time, it's familiar to others who went through the same thing. And even some of the early fathers, like St. Gregory of Nyssa, were mystics. We'll go through the characteristics of mystics. But it's good for us to notice that it connects up with the earlier history of religion. It's not just a Christian possibility. So there are mystics, as I point out in the book, in Judaism, in Islam. Every religion has a mystical dimension to it.
So was what we experienced last week?
Very much so. Yeah. Yeah, that was an exact example, because each person felt it in his or her own way. Like I felt it connected to family, and you felt it in your way. But yet, we were all experiencing it together. Exactly like the original style of mysticism in pagan times. By the way, kind of humorous, St. Clement it's making fun of the ancient mysteries, says something that is very ironic. I've always remembered this, kind of humorous. Remember I said that the high point of the ceremony was the holding aloft of wheat. Mm-hmm. And he says, imagine thinking that a religious ceremony, the highest point of it would be holding aloft something made of wheat. The very thing that would happen in the Mass.
Yeah.
So,
anyway.
And mysticism has always been suspect in the official church, mm-hmm. because often the revelations that come through don't quite fit with the official teachings. For instance, as we'll talk about next week, one of the official teachings is that if you have been sinful and not repentant, then you will certainly go to hell forever and suffer. And as Judy just read, that does not match the realization that Juliana of Norwich had, 14th century English mystic. She had this vision in which she realized that God has such goodness that it wouldn't be in God to punish forever for things that, for choices that people made in this temporary mortal life. So that doesn't match the official teaching. That's why mysticism is suspect.
St. Francis was one of the first to believe that in a loving God rather than a vengeful God.
Mm-hmm.
And, as a result, he was kind of on the fringe, considered to be on the fringe of the official church.
Yes, in many ways. Keith, do you have a comment? Keith is a Franciscan priest.
Yeah. Yeah. And yet Francis really, he didn't want to separate himself.
He wanted to remain in connection. Yes.
Yeah.
He maintained the connection,
yeah.
And that was important.
Where many of the others, there are many movements at the same time,
mm-hmm.
very similar, who went off in all directions. I feel sometimes maybe I'm more that way now, saying, well, institution just doesn't understand. Goodbye. I'm off myself. You know?
Yeah.
It's a temptation.
Very much so.
But at that time, he would have been called a heretic, and they did bad things there.
Oh, yeah.
He was pretty smart to stay in the...
Yes, he was. Although I don't think he did it for that motivation.
No.
That was just his style.
Good, okay. And for those that have the book, I'm over on page 50. So William James, the famous commentator on religion, a psychologist, came up with four main qualities of mystical experience. The first is that it's indescribable. You can't quite put it into words. For instance, our experience last week, we can talk somewhat about it, but we also have the feeling that something was happening that you can't quite express. It can't be put into words, ultimately. Secondly, that you move, as Martha in her example gave, you move from believing into knowing. Suddenly you just know, rather than believe anymore. You realize that it's a grace, that you didn't make it happen, that it's a gift that comes to you. What is this gift? Some intuition or realization or feeling of connectedness with the wider world that nonetheless fits with your religious experience. Fourth, it's transient, it's temporary. It happens and then you come back to the ordinary world. One of the main qualities is a direct, and this one is certainly threatening to the official church, direct contact with the divine without the use of mediators. Suddenly you realize that you can have a direct experience, that I don't always have to go through the church and the sacraments and the teaching. You will feel it in your body and through your body, but it's not only bodily. So, for instance, St. Joseph of Cupertino had the experience of levitation. St. Francis had the stigmata. St. Teresa had erotic sensations when she had mystical experiences. So the body joins in. This is another way we have of trusting something. It's hard to trust an experience that doesn't bring the body in with it. Mystics seem to have less interest in theological discussion. Remember the famous story of St. Thomas Aquinas after he had written the Summa Theologica, which re-expressed Catholic theology from the perspective of Aristotle instead of Plato. And when he finished the book, he had a vision of Christ. And Christ said, well hast thou written of me, Thomas. What reward will you have? And he said, nil te ipsum domine. Nothing but yourself, O Lord. And after this experience, he looked at the books and realized that the books came nowhere close to the real thing. So he went to the fireplace to throw them in. And just at that moment, a brother came to the door and saw him and grabbed the books and said, no, no, don't burn them. He said, no, they're all like straw compared to the real thing. So that's the kind of experience a mystic has. Also, whatever your personal view or image of God may be, you find that it's too narrow. It has to be much bigger than what you were taught. You have that feeling when you look at Kenya's, the pictures, the holy cards. When you look at those pictures, one of the feelings you have, besides nostalgia, is, oh, well, what a narrow view this is of what it's all about. It doesn't have the bigness of the universe that Teilhard de Chardin brought in. It feels timeless, a mystical experience. So you go beyond time and place. Beyond time and place is the equivalent of entering into a realm that is bigger than what the human mind can hold. All the mystics seem to grow in love of others. They didn't just hold it within themselves. And finally, and this is a very big one, you realize that there's no separation between the self and God. And that whatever is meant by God and whatever is meant by the self is just all one thing. St. John of the Cross expresses this well in the Ascent of Mount Carmel. God communicates to the soul his supernatural being so that the soul appears to be God himself and has all that God himself has. All the things of God and the soul are one in participant transformation, and the soul seems to be God rather than a soul, and indeed is God by participation. See how different that is from a catechism description of the self and God? So those are the qualities of a mystical experience, and you can see that all of us have had experiences like this. Any questions about this part? Mary?
Death on my mother's death, even. I feel like there was this process where she kind of became connected. There's a transformation. I feel that in people around me and myself, but as I age, this seems to
happen more naturally.
Deeper and wider.
Mm-hmm. Yes. That's a very good point, Mary. And there's another part to this, which is that in the style of Catholicism that many of us were brought up in, there was no room for the stages of life. Everybody was supposed to have the same exact view, whether you were 5 years old or 95. It's the same exact catechism questions and answers. They wanted us all in that same category. They didn't make room for what you just brought up. But as you get older, your views mature and you're not tied to the childish version of something. That you move more into something like this that we've just been describing. That would have been suspicious to the official church when we were growing up. Now there's more openness to it. I mean, not more openness to it in the official church, but more openness among us.
In the real church.
Yeah.
This whole description seems to me to be the whole basis of Jesus' experience and his public ministry, so that what he experienced at the time of his baptism, he then went out to make available and to awaken in other people, because that was this experience of union with God and all others. Well, how far we have come from that, we immediately divided it off into the experience belonged only to him and isn't available to anybody else. I mean, as much as the church has criticized Gnosticism, the institutional church is the most Gnostic of all, because they say they're the only ones that have access to this higher knowledge, and when in fact, that's not true. Mm-hmm. He came very far, that's my point, from the original gospel.
Yes.
That Jesus tried to, it was really an availability and an encounter with the divine that he was trying to make accessible to everybody. And we come very far from that.
Mm-hmm. Very good point. Hi, Jane.
Yeah. How is mysticism different from enlightenment in the Buddhist and Hindu traditions, which is a non-transient but permanent experience open to all essences?
Mm-hmm.
But it's like you become enlightened and you carry that forward. It does not end in time.
Good point.
Say a little bit about that. Jean's bringing up a word that you've heard from Buddhism, especially enlightenment.
And this enlightenment could happen gradually or it could happen suddenly. Usually it's thought of as a sudden awakening. What is this awakening that they're referring to? Is that you suddenly get it, that there is no separate self, that there's a total oneness of what you call yourself and the universe, and that as long as you're caught in fear or desire, desire meaning grasping, when you're still trying to get more and more, or afraid of the ordinary events that happen in life, when you're caught there, you don't allow yourself to awaken. And that everybody has this awakened state within, but that fear and desire prevents it from actually appearing. And that once you have this great awakening, then you remain in this state for the rest of your life. And that was the experience of Saint Teresa of Avila. She said, I stayed in this state. I didn't always stay enraptured, but once I had this mystical realization, I never went back to the ordinary way of looking at things.
What is faith command?
Faith in this enlightenment view doesn't come in strongly. They don't use that word the same way we do. But in a mystical experience, your faith changes.
Instead of it being thought of as a set of beliefs, which is how we were taught about faith, it's a deeper way of knowing.
Can you explain fear or desire again? I think I missed something there.
Yeah. Let me just say something about the deeper way of knowing. The way you know the timetable is different from the way you know your son. You know both, but you can't quite, and we use the word know about the timetables and know about your son. But if you stop to look at it, it's a different way of knowing. It's the way you know your son is in a deeper, indescribable way. It's very clear to you, but you couldn't really put it into words. That's how faith changes. It becomes the kind of faith of knowing God the way you know your son or daughter or husband, mother, or whatever.
Intuitive.
Instead of, yeah, it's more of an intuitive and a felt sense of someone, which you don't have with the timetables. You only have the memorization of them, but you haven't entered into them in the same way that you have knowledge of someone you love.
Would that be awareness, a super awareness?
It's a, yeah, it's a special kind of awareness. Well, everybody see the difference?
I can contemplate the alphabet. Imagine that wonderful song. A, you're adorable. B, you're so beautiful. C, you're a beautiful charm.
Mm-hmm.
So anything can be mystical.
Yeah, if you really get into it. Oh, and numbers were mystical to Pythagoras.
Yeah, one of the mystical philosophers.
Now, I'm not clearly understanding the contrast between enlightenment and mystical experience. And I think that with something about one being transient, mystical experience being transient, but enlightenment is a permanent state. Is that what you said?
The enlightenment doesn't have a religious perspective. There's no God. There's no sense of one with the divine life. They don't use those. They don't use that way of expressing things. It's a total freedom from division. Total freedom from being a separate self out there in the world into, this is all just one experience, and it has no sense of an afterlife or of being part of a community of saints or communion of saints. It's bigger than all that. Yeah.
Actually, it does.
It has the bodhisattva part of it. Does.
Yes.
But not in their same religious sense that
not
we do.
Not the separate, no. But definitely there's the sense of oneness with all, mm-hmm. and which is very beautiful and
mm-hmm.
mystical.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a communion. Robert Sherman calls it the rainbow body, which is all the enlightened ones. So they are like the same.
Okay, let me mention that. An enlightened person is called a Buddha, which just means enlightened or awake. And then the same word is expanded as bodhisattva is an enlightened person who does not want to accept full liberation until everybody else is enlightened too. Mm-hmm. And so these are the people who want to keep coming back time after time to help us find enlightenment. So in that sense, it's something like the communion of saints, but not exactly the same.
I'm thinking of Little Teresa.
I will spend my eternity doing good for others. Mm-hmm. Yes.
It seems to me to highlight this tension between the already but not yet, and the transient sense of a mystical experience is, for me, that you have this unmediated experience of unity, and maybe this is where Blanche's question comes in about faith, but it's not yet fulfilled in that the whole creation isn't, well, it is at some level, but at another level, you don't experience it in the world around you as being complete or fulfilled, and this is what you're talking about, coming back until it's all completed. I have a sense of that myself, that, you know, we say that Jesus died, but he rose, but Jesus is still here. Same way as all of us who die in Christ, we're not finished in the sense that we participate in some way in the fulfillment of this. So there's this, it takes faith, I think, to believe the experience, because it is sort of transient. It comes, you get a whiff of it, you know it, and you can't go back to not knowing it. It's not like you have any choice. Once you know it at that deep level, you know it.
Mm.
But, I mean, you know what you know what you know, and you can't go back to unknowing it, but you have to live then. It takes, in the human condition, a lifetime to release the desire and the fear.
Or more than one lifetime.
Yeah, or more than one lifetime. And so there's this tension between the already and the not yet that happens in this type of experience, I think. So you live in it because you know it at a deep level, and it can't leave you because it's been awakened in you. But you still have to deal with your own humanity and getting the little small self out of the way enough for this to enlarge within you, something like that. So there's a tension there.
Mm. In the Zen view, they use that expression, the big mind, as opposed to the little mind. And the already and not yet also fits with the enlightenment story, because everybody is already enlightened. It's just that we can't know it as long as we're caught in fear and desire.
Mm.
So it's another way of saying that even without the idea of God, there's still some mystical or enlightened way that people have found.
Yeah.
Christian?
Well, since I am reading this book, and this is an Indian woman who I can't pronounce her name, Ananda Maya Ma, who lived pretty much a mystical life since very young. Talk of an evolved being from the very start. And she had 2 years of elementary school education, and 19 volumes of insights were written about things that came to her through her mystical experiences. And here, and at the end of the chapter on her life, Timothy gives some of these insights. And realize the God self, she says, God is the breath of life, the heart of heart, the self. To find him is to find oneself. Truly to know oneself means to know him. Having found oneself, all questions and problems are solved. To find the beloved is to find myself. Self-realization is God-realization, and God-realization is self-realization. I mean, it goes on and on and on. So it's very strongly connected to God.
Yes, very much so. Well, Hinduism has the divine sense. Yes?
It seems a little different, but if you go on a guided meditation and you have an experience, would that be...
Absolutely. Yes. It's anything that takes you out of your narrow categories and shows you that, there's something much bigger going on that I'm participating in. And it can't be formulated in these narrow ways that I've been brought up with. Any moment like that is the enlightened moment or mystical moment. I guess the central realization is that there's no God out there, or as Thomas Merton says, God is not someone else. That's the main mystical realization. So the idea of a supreme being, God is a supreme being, there would be nothing like that in mysticism. There's no separate being. It's God is at the same time the deepest soulful part of ourselves and everywhere in the universe. So there is no separate God up in heaven looking down like Michelangelo's ceiling of the Sistine Chapel God. That's just an image or metaphor, but a very narrow one from the mystical perspective. Yes, inmost and utmost would be good as a way of looking at it. Now, just make one other distinction, which you'll also find in the book. It's cataphatic, I'll explain these words, and apophatic. Don't be scared off by the words. If they're easy to understand. I'm on 52. So mystical experience is apophatic,
which means that it's the half, the darker
things are not clearly stated and clearly expressible. And katabatic is the lighted path in which everything is clearly understood.
So you, in the cataphatic style, you respond intellectually to the teachings, and you have your use of reason and imagination and memory to assimilate the truths of your faith. And it's a knowing mind, as in Job 19:25, I know that my Redeemer lives and that I shall see him face to face on the last day. That's cataphatic style. And that would be the style that we were brought up with mainly. Apophatic is simply resting in God beyond concepts and actions. It's a pausing into the divine, a loving sense of a divine presence, but with a don't know mind. I can't describe it. I can't put it into words. As St. John of the Cross says in one of his poems, I entered I knew not where, and there I stood not knowing, nothing left to know. This was a high point of the experience of God, nothing left to know. That's the opposite of the other style, the cataphatic one. And here's one from 6th century Syrian monk, Pseudo-Dionysius, we know him as, quote, we go beyond name and form, beyond being and concept, into a divine darkness, and we know by not knowing. And the Jan von Reisbrook, who is a follower of Master Eckhart, quote, a waylessness and darkness in which we never find ourselves again in a creaturely way. God is a simple nudity, an incomprehensible light. And to find this light, one finds himself and feels himself to be that light. So you can't quite put it into words, as I'm saying here. Waylessness means that for once our human task is not the heroic journey. That's the cataphatic style, heroic journey archetype. Now the challenge is to have no path and no destination. Something like the style of seeking the Holy Grail, in which the knights entered the forest where there was no path and didn't know what they were looking for. They didn't know what the Grail looked like. That's a perfect description of the apophatic style. Using the intellect, we only get God as a supreme being, a holy other. But mystical consciousness makes it possible to find the God within. And here's one final quote by Nicholas of Cusa. This is a Renaissance cardinal, also a mystic. I learned that the place where you are found unveiled is girt round with a combination of opposites, and this is actually the wall of paradise. But the door is guarded by the spirit of reason, and unless he is vanquished, the way will never open. So as long as you're still using your intellect, you could never enter into this deeper way of being with God. You would have to let go of that, finally.
Would they be like letting go of your ego, basically?
Yes, basically ego is your intellect and will. Letting go of all that and just entering into this place. And I think it's such an important distinction. Like, there's a time when it feels like an heroic journey, but there's another time at which it feels like no path. And you may be in this part of your spiritual story. It would be felt as nothing really works, nothing really grabs me. I'm no longer
moved by the traditional rituals. I feel like I don't have a specific path I can follow, but at the same time I feel closer to whatever the divine is about. You can see how this would be difficult for the official church to acknowledge. Someone said to me once that he was a non-believer, but he said something I've always remembered and I've thought about over the years. He said, "You're only fully free when you can invent your own sacraments." As long as you're tied to the seven, these are the only means of grace in the way they're done, that you're still kind of caught there. But that when something opens for you, you say, "Oh, being under this oak tree is a sacrament, a sign of an experience of grace." And Christ sat under trees too, so he instituted this. You know, when start doing it, start things like that start to happen to you, you're opening in a new way.
Isn't it because we emphasize the tangible? In other words, we have to kind of feel, taste, and see.
Yes. Yeah.
Yesterday in U.S. News, there was just a little article about the scientists in the Hubble telescope.
Yeah.
They found a dark circle that is nothing, but it's nothing but energy. And so they're astounded at it. It struck me with all the talk about circles now that a dark circle comes up for energy. They don't really know what it is, but it's the first time they've ever encountered it.
It's no thing, but it's real and present.
Yeah.
And what a beautiful description of God. No one thing, but present. And fits with Nicholas of Cusa's other famous statement, God is a metaphor for a circle, the center of which is everywhere, the circumference of which is nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
See how much bigger that is than God is a supreme being. We're going to take a short break,
okay,
but just
fine.
Let's have one last comment or question.
I was just wondering if person experiences God in an apophatic way, that it can give new meaning to the knowledge acquired at Catholic that it brings it up to a new level of interpretation.
Yes, you would reconsider everything from the original view and
but
see it in a whole new way.
Meaning
yes.
And the two work hand in hand.
Yes, and we are doing that.
Mm-hmm.
We're considering all the things, the Sacred Heart itself. I mean, we're looking back at a traditional image, but we're looking at it in a new way that's much more expansive and spacious. Rather than, this is the heart that you wounded by your sins and you have to make reparation. That's narrow and blaming. It doesn't honor the heart as the center of the universe.
I see the apophatic has the lighted path.
Oh, yes. Yes. In a combination of opposites. Okay, let's take a short break and then we'll continue.